When I started on YouTube, I didn't know anything about it. How do you learn to play a great melody? That's one thing you can't teach.
What are the things, though, that you were working on that you felt made you a better improviser?
People that are going to be successful in an AI-dominated world are the people that are already successful. I never practiced a scale, an arpeggio, nothing. I never sat around and noodled.
When you think about how you've learned as much as you've learned about music, was it sequential, or were there periods where you were learning about multiple things at one time? What people say is, how is it possible that Rick Beato has such a wide knowledge of music? Do you feel like you've had this ability to keep or continue learning as maybe some of your peers have sort of settled in with their knowledge base?
Yeah, well, maybe, I don't know.
No, but don't be humble. Yes. Isn't it crazy how many legendary people you've brought to your home in Atlanta?
I don't think about it.
So what are the tips for someone starting a YouTube channel?
I asked him about that lick.
And what did he say? Can't talk about it. Now we're rolling.
He's like, we just look for stuff that sounded good. That's what he was saying. You know, he just... Because he grew up, you know, it's like right after the Beatles, they came out. First record was in 1968. And all the songs of all the bands in the early 60s, you know, the British Invasion, the Beatles and the Stones and everything, they had amazing intros and stuff. So it's like, that's how you learn. It's like, oh, we have to have a good riff. And all their songs have amazing intros.
They do, right? They're all CCR iconic. Songs,
oh my God, phenomenal intros.
What makes a great intro?
Something that has a signature that you can sing.
Yeah.
You know?
You love the intro to Angie, right? That's your favorite Rolling Stones song.
That's amazing.
Why do you love that intro?
Because it's got a very weird parts to it and everything. Those sus chords and everything, and got an inverted E7 chord right there. Just stuff that they couldn't put in books because nobody could figure it out back when I was a kid. You had to have a really good ear.
And you had a good ear because you just naturally had a good ear because your mom played a little guitar?
I had a good ear because I think people in my family have good ears.
I love this story though, which is almost, it's so touching that you and your brother would play guitar together. He would play, or you would play rhythm and he would play lead. And then
for 10 minutes,
for 10 minutes.
Lead. And then as soon as I started to play lead, he'd put his guitar down and run and we'd go fight then.
And your mom would then play rhythm.
Well, then my mom would finally get fed up with us fighting. And she's like, I'll play rhythm for you. So she would play Hey Joe for 10 minutes and I would solo.
Isn't that the most touching thing? That's incredible.
I never even thought about it. It was how cool that was that my mom would do that.
She'd say, what are the chords? And then she would pick it up and play.
I said, it starts in E and then C, G, D, A, E. And she's like, okay. She's like, when's it change? And I said, I'll just play through one time. She's like, okay, I got it.
That's it. Rick Beato on the podcast. I can't believe it. It is so great to see you. We are live from, what do you call this place? It's the studio.
Yeah, the studio.
That's what you call it? The studio?
I never thought about it.
There's no name for, is there a name for the home studio or no? It's just, we're here.
Yeah.
Rick Beato.
This is the live room.
This is the live room that we're in. Yeah. You are at the center of music YouTube. You're the eye of the hurricane. It feels like there's no one bigger than you. Does it feel like that? Do you acknowledge that?
I don't even think about it.
But not at all?
No.
What do you think about in regards to the channel?
I look at my schedule and I see what I got coming out. There's always a bunch of things that are unfinished going on and stuff. And then there's a lot of topical things related to the news. If something, you know, if there's an interesting, like the Velvet Sundown thing that came out, the AI band, that was really interesting. People were talking about that. People were sending me stuff. A lot of times people, musician friends send me stuff all the time. This might make a good episode. And a lot of times it does.
Yeah.
So then it's like, whatever we're working on, oh, let's make this video. And then we make it. But a lot of my videos I make, we come in and I make it in the morning, put it out in the afternoon. So. Yeah.
And that's it.
That's it.
For someone like myself, who is trying to grow a YouTube channel, I don't really have the knowledge that you have from your experience, your stories, your career. So what does someone in my position have to offer on YouTube that comes so naturally to you? I can't pretend to do the things that you do on YouTube.
When I started on YouTube, I didn't know anything about it. As a matter of fact, there was a music channel that had 47,000 subscribers. It was called Piano Around the World. The guy that had it, Dotan, would move his piano, like go to France, and he'd push it out into the center of a square and stuff and start playing. Then people would come in and join in and play with him and stuff, and he'd film it. And he reached out to me early on in my channel, and I said, how do you make money on YouTube? Like, you've had these videos that have millions of views. He goes, oh, you don't make any money from that. I was like, what? Then why do you do it? Well, it's just fun. Oh, okay. And so I didn't know anybody that knew anything. Nobody knew anything. So you just make videos and kind of figure out stuff as it goes. And I do it because I have fun and I make videos about things I'm interested in. So.
Is that the answer, though, to just make videos on what you're interested in?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard, though, because I don't have the music knowledge, even though I'm a trained musician. When you do this, like what makes a song great, does that stuff really come that naturally to you, or do you sit down and prep it beforehand?
When I was 32 years old, I moved here to Atlanta. And I started working in a Blockbuster Music. You probably don't remember that, but I was wearing a blue polyester shirt and I would open up albums and or CDs and I put them on a thing for people to listen to, listening stations when you test them out, and then I close them back up and stuff. And then I worked and I got a job at a music store teaching guitar lessons because I'd already been a college professor for 5 years that I quit because I got signed to a publishing deal, which ended up not going anywhere. So I started with 4 students in one day, and then I built it up to where I was teaching 50 students a week. So 10 students a day, 5 days a week. And I taught every song you can ever imagine. I had guitar players, bass players, you know, and every record, punk rock records, yacht rock records, if you want to call it that, anything. Like I would teach every song off a Steely Dan record. I'd teach every song off a Less Than Jake record. I would teach every song off... you name it, metal, grunge, you know, 50s music, whatever it is, the Beatles songs. I teach every Stones song. So that was basically the prep for that thing. So when I'm doing these breakdowns of these things, what makes a song great? I already knew how to play all the songs.
Yeah. I've heard you say in an interview that when you were a teacher at Ithaca College, you basically said that unless your student was already a great improviser, they basically never became a good improviser. That you couldn't figure out how to teach them to become a great improviser. Do you remember saying that?
I think about an interview when I interviewed Pat Metheny, and it was how do you learn to play a great melody? Because he's one of the greatest melody players there is. And he's like, that's one thing you can't teach.
Right.
Because it requires taste. It's kind of like people that are worried about AI taking their jobs. Well, the people that are going to be successful in an AI-dominated world are the people that are already successful. The people that are already hit songwriters are going to know when they prompt something, if they use AI to write to help them with their writing, they're going to know what a good idea is and what isn't. And the people that aren't good, that don't have the talent for that, are not going to know when they've stumbled on something good or bad. And they'll just put out anything. So a lot of this stuff is just people that instantly know what a good melody is because they have good taste. So it's
So when you were at Ithaca College teaching and you had a student who just didn't know how to improvise, is it really tough to teach them? Or
it's difficult. Yeah, because I mean you can say everything. It's like, okay, on a G minor chord, the chord tones are G, B flat, D. You can play a Dorian scale on it, which would be this. It's got a natural E in it. Or you could play Aeolian, which has the note E flat in it, the flat six and everything. You can tell them all this stuff. You can play a lick. I mean, the best way to do it is actually just learn people's solos. And that's how you learn phrases. But you can't show them where to take break, where to put spaces. You can't show them how to have good rhythm. You can tell them to play with a metronome, but you can't practice for them. And, a lot of this stuff comes from trial and error and practice and having a good, you know, some people become amazing, would become amazing players, but it's difficult to teach improvising. You can teach things on the guitar. You can teach somebody to be a great guitar player and have a huge Instagram following or whatever. People that can learn things off. But when it comes to improvising, not many people really truly improvise. That's the thing. Most rock songs that you hear, the solos are already worked out ahead of time. And that historically was the case because to save studio time, because it was $2,500 a day back in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, you didn't want to have your stuff figured out. You did pre-production and nobody was going in and improvising stuff. Or you were a band like Van Halen where Eddie, they already had all their stuff worked out when right. they went in the studio. And Eddie was such a great player. You listen to the room mics of Eruption, the drum mics, and he's playing it live in the studio, one take.
Yeah.
No mistakes. They think they faded out the feedback between a couple of the phrases and everything. That was it. It was like, that's the take. It's a take.
You've done a video, though, talking about different types of intelligence and how most of the biggest rock stars basically peaked with their creative output in their 30s. And then you talked about, what were the two types of intelligence that you mentioned in that video?
There's fluid intelligence
yes.
and crystallized intelligence.
Yes. What's the difference between the two?
Well, people that are usually below 30 or up to 30, up to maybe in the early 30s, have these abilities to, because their brain is processing at its highest, you know, capacity that it can throughout your life. And so that's why you find people that do creative things, or people that are, you know, mathematics, people that have made mathematical discoveries, things like that, that usually do it in their 20s. The Beatles had their entire career before anyone turned 30. Lennon and Ringo turned 30 in 1970, the year they broke up. I think Lennon's birthday is, I always get this wrong. Is it November 9th or December? It was November 9th. He turned 30. And they were already broken up by then. Ringo turned 30. He probably turned 30 right when they were breaking up. But, you know, the Stones, Exile Main Street, they were both, Keith and Mick were 29 then. And that was their 10th record.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a double record.
Right. So but I think I'm 29. So I'm right at the end of this.
Yeah.
I do not feel like I am the improviser that I want to be at the end of my career. I feel very, I mean, like you kind of explained, I can learn a lot. But I would love to be a better improviser. Am I out of luck?
You know, it's interesting. I was a jazz musician for a living up, you know, basically from 87 to 92 or so when I was teaching jazz studies up in Ithaca, New York. And I would play 5-6 nights a week, play jazz gigs. And I was improvising all the time. And then when I stopped doing that and I quit teaching left there, I never played a solo. Even in my band, we didn't really have solos, and we did, we split them up and they were just short little melody things. I didn't play a guitar solo until 2016 when I started my YouTube channel. So from 1991 to 2016, I did no lead playing at all. I never practiced a scale, an arpeggio, nothing. I never sat around and noodled, because when I was producing, there were no solos in any songs. It was metal. It was new metal, whatever. There were no guitar solos. So, and all my guitars were tuned down really low. So I never even had a guitar tuned to standard. So I never would sit around and just play. Because I always sounded weird when it was tuned down to B or down to A or whatever.
Right.
So by the time I started playing again for my YouTube channel, started teaching things, it was like I'd forgot everything I knew. So I started from scratch. So I had no licks that were under my fingers. So I was able to kind of start fresh. And it was actually good because my playing, I thought, it was far more interesting than it was from what I remember because I didn't have any recordings of it back in the late 80s, early 90s. But I think that I play completely different kinds of ideas than I used to. So never say never. And it's not, you know, I was in my 50s, 54 when I started my YouTube channel. So you got nothing to worry about.
What are the things, though, that you were working on? And maybe you talk about this in your new Scale Matrix course. It's a little plug right there.
Nice.
What are the things, though, that you were working on that you felt made you a better improviser in your 50s than you were when you were significantly younger?
I think that I knew a lot more about music. And I was very closed off in the music that I liked back in my 20s, and I really only listened to jazz. And then I started playing in rock bands and writing songs, and started, which really required to know how to write good melodies, simple melodies. And I think that was the thing that really developed my ability to write, is actually writing songs. And you usually do that by singing the stuff. So then I would sing, and then I would, you know, get the things under my fingers. So that's one skill. That's one way to improve your lead playing, is to actually sing the things and then figure out what you sang. Cause it's much more natural to sing a solo, cause you put breaks in, cause you have to breathe and things like that, than it is to just kind of have just play patterns and things like that.
Right.
So
you did a video recently talking about different classical eras, and we're breaking them all down. Can you give a couple examples of, I don't even know, like the right pieces to listen to from each era if you're trying to have a better understanding of classical music? Because I feel like that was a little bit of your goal with the video, was I think you were pointing out that this stuff is unreal and not a lot of people know it, right?
Well, the goal of the video was to, I had to think of a video that I could, where I could just play this one Bach
piece. Play that one Bach piece. Yeah, yeah, right? Exactly.
I was like, okay, so what can I talk about? Well, I'll talk about different style periods and everything.
Yeah.
And then I'll play this piece that people don't know that's amazing.
Right.
And so the whole first part of the video was basically to create a storyline that would lead to this Bach piece. And then I said, I actually just made this so you just to listen to this.
Right. That is what you said.
Right.
I feel like, though, I took one course in classical music at music school, and I always think, God, I would love to have more knowledge about classical music, but I find it to be kind of overwhelming to know where to jump in.
Just pick one composer.
Yeah.
If you took one composer from the Renaissance, John Dowland. Okay. Now, Sting made a record of John Dowland's music, but there's a record that I took out called Dances of Dowland. That's Julian Bream playing lute. That's amazing. And it's all John Dowland music. And if you just had a record like that and listen to it, just become familiar with that. You don't have to listen to Josquin du Pré or any of the, I mean, name 20 Renaissance composers. You don't need to know that. Just take one at a time, and then take one Baroque composer. You can take Bach, but take, you know, the Well-Tempered Clavier, book one, and just start with that. Listen through that, right? And then finish that, book two. Then maybe the Brandenburg Concertos, the Goldberg Variations, the, you know, there's so many Bach pieces, but there's so many great Baroque composers, classical composers, you know, Mozart, Haydn, two biggest, Beethoven, kind of bridged the gap or bridge between the classical era and the Romantic era. But, you know, start with a couple Mozart symphonies or something, or some piano concertos. Just look up whatever the most famous things are on Spotify. Start there.
Yeah. When you think about how you've learned as much as you've learned about music, was it sequential, or were there periods where you were learning about multiple things at one time? Or was there a period where you focused on just classical and got really knowledgeable about that, and then just jazz, and then maybe rock and pop when you were younger?
Rock and pop when I was younger. And then in my undergrad was in classical bass. So all I did was classical music. So I played in the orchestra. I had music history classes. I was a music ed major, so I played all different instruments. I was a string instrumental major, so I had to take class violin, class viola, class cello. I started on the cello. Then I took bass lessons all the time. And then I'm in the listening lab studying for music history classes. And then you're listening to records constantly. And then you're being tested on it, right? So, and then when I went to grad school, you had four sections of music theory, two sections of music history that you had to pass in order to get your master's degree at New England Conservatory, where I went and got a jazz guitar degree. So you had to pass those, otherwise you couldn't get your degree. And you had 2 years to pass these six sections, right? Well, I passed all of them the first time, even before I started. So I only took electives. So I passed the classical theory parts, which jazz players had a lot of trouble with that because they had no exposure to classical music.
Right.
Right. So I was obsessed with classical music when I was a kid. And my dad listened to jazz all the time. Every day was listening to jazz. So we always heard jazz. We always heard classical music. And I have six siblings and they all like different kinds of music. So we had music going on all over the house.
The thing that people marvel about you, though, this is what they say behind your back. In case you don't know. No, it's good. What people say is, how is it possible that Rick Beato has such a wide knowledge of music? And I hang around brilliant, brilliant musicians who feel that way about you. So maybe it doesn't feel miraculous or special because you're you, but somewhere along your line, you have this ability to just pick up information and to really dive deep into such a wide topic of things. Does that just come so naturally to you?
So when I would go in to the listening lab to listen to a piece, if I was listening to Prokofiev's Second Piano Concerto, I would have the score and I would read the score.
Yeah.
I wouldn't just listen to the piece. I would look, I would read the score. I'd see what everything is doing. I mean, I took arranging classes. I taught arranging. I taught big band arranging. I conducted a big band for years. I can read all the different clefs fluidly, fluently, I guess both. And I mean, I'm 63 years old. I've had a lot of experience, but I went through periods where I only listened to 20th century classical music, and I taught jazz history. So jazz history is basically the history of albums. I mean, yes, it's how jazz developed, but it's also the history of albums. I went into a store in Austin recently. I was down there and it was called Austin Vintage Guitar. So I walk in, there's a guy playing in the back and I was like, oh, sounds good in this back room. So I walk in and everything and I'm listening to play the fusion kind of stuff and everything. And he looks over, he goes, oh my God, Rick Beato. And I was like, hey, what's up, man? So he goes, we're talking for a minute. He goes, do you know what this is? And he starts playing. I'm like, yeah, it's Cannonball Adderley's solo from Milestones. He's like, how do you know that?
Right. Yeah.
He's like, what are you talking about? I know every note on that record. I said, did you ever notice that the song slows down like 10 beats from the beginning to the end? He's like, what? I said, yeah. So I open it up on my phone. I play the beginning. Bup, 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 bup. And then at the end, it's like, do, 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 do. I'm singing it in the wrong key. But it slows down like 10 beats throughout the song. He's like, how'd you notice that? I said, because I used to listen to it on an album. When I was going to the second track, I'd move the thing over and I'd be like, oh my God, because you'd miss the beginning of the song and be like, wow, that's way slower.
Right. But I think there are so many people that I could point to in your age demo, let's say,
yeah,
who are musically brilliant, but that brilliance might be in a very specialized place in music. Someone I think of, Guthrie Trapp, for example, is one of the best chicken pickers, does not know a lot about.
That's awesome.
Unbelievable. You had him on the show. He does not know really about classical music to a great degree, and I think he'd admit that. I am always inspired by your breadth of knowledge, and I think most people don't have that knowledge on such a wide scale of things, and I'm just curious how you think you developed it. And time is the answer, but you've gone so wide on it.
But when I was in sixth grade, I was playing the cello because I took this music aptitude test in third grade called the Seashore Test. And everybody in my school district, Fairport Central Schools in upstate New York, we had 11 full-time music faculty, okay? My graduating class was about 650 people. You had to pass a music aptitude test in order to get into the program. And they would do things like they would play minute differences on a synthesizer in the Seashore Test, where it wouldn't be like a half step. It'd be two notes that are 5 cents off. Is the second note higher or lower?
Oh my God.
Yes. And so you had to have incredible pitch discrimination, and they picked the people that had the best ears, and they would be the people that played strings first, then, because you start in fourth grade on strings, you start in fifth grade on brass or on wind instruments for the band. So I started on the cello, and right away, you're learning repertoire. So but when I was in sixth grade, at the end of sixth grade, they're like, I was tall enough to learn the bass and everything. And so my teacher, Ken Brown, was like, Rick, would you be interested in switching to bass? And I said, Yeah. He said, okay, well, I have this thing, this chamber music thing that we're doing. You're going to, and I'm going to give you lessons over the summer. So, okay. So I bring a bass to my house. Everyone had their own instrument in the, like, does the school own? They own five. I asked him, he's retired now.
This is upright bass, right?
Upright bass. Yeah. They have 500 string instruments that the school district owns. 500 string instruments. They own all the band instruments too. That's an insane amount of string instruments for a suburb of Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
Just the string program has that many, right? So I had a bass at school and at home to practice, right? So they had two for every bass player. So I start learning the bass, taking lessons, and then I go into this chamber music thing, and it's the Bach Brandenburg Concerto number 3 in G major. And so I go to the library and I get it out, the record, and I start listening to it. I'm like, this is unbelievable. And then all of a sudden I start playing along, reading the music and playing along. I was like, this is amazing. And then I took out every Bach record I could find. I was like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. And then I started taking in all these different composers. And I recognized all these things that we were playing them in the orchestra. So I would take these composers and I would listen to them just nonstop. And then I picked up the guitar in eighth grade and I learned everything off every record, you know, because I was just like, oh, as soon as I learned the first chord of A minor, I was like, that's the first chord in Angie, whatever.
Yeah.
Or that's, you know, like this first chord in a lot of songs.
Have you noticed, though, do you feel like you've had this ability to keep or continue learning as maybe some of your peers have sort of settled in with their knowledge base?
Yeah. Well, maybe. I don't know.
No, but don't be humble. Yes. That's how I feel like when – that's my impression of you.
The thing that blows me away is that a lot of my friends that are pro musicians have very narrow
– this is what I'm getting at.
Extremely narrow taste.
Yes.
Where they only like one kind of music. And I'm like, that's really weird. It must be boring. Like, how do you not know anything about Bach?
Yeah.
When so much of Western music came from – I mean, this like the – it's the most beautiful music ever imagined by a human being. And to not know that or to not even be familiar with it to me is very strange. I don't know. But I mean, if you never were experienced it or, you know, then it's not strange. But it's like, what? Aren't you curious about other kinds of music? That was my thing. You know, I mean, like I said, I produced metal bands. There was no metal the metal I grew up in, you know, you think about metal from maybe the 70s or, you know, Black Sabbath, late 60s, 70s. And then you have the thrash metal, you know, with Metallica and Megadeth and Slayer and Anthrax of the early 80s or mid 80s. And then new metal that happened, bands like Korn and Limp Bizkit and all the new metal. And then you have the kind of hardcore metal that happened, and, you know, like Under Oath, bands like that in the early 2000s and stuff like that. So I was constantly listening to all this new music because I was producing bands like that. And so when you're listening to that stuff all the time, you become aware of like what kind of guitar tones they use, what kind of drum tones, what kind of snare sounds, what kind of bass drum sounds, are they using samples? And then you just are obsessive. We studied records nonstop here and tried to get sounds. Every day that I had off, Ken, who's in here recording this right now, and I would sit here and we would try and get sounds off records. We would try to how do we get the kick drum sound from Back in Black? How do we get that snare sound? It's the most amazing snare sound I ever heard. Can we recreate it somehow? What does it take to do that?
Right. Yes.
And so it's just this insane curiosity for...
I think, though, what limited my exploration of music is when I got really into music in middle school, I was in a new school. I left all my friends behind. I was listening to music because I felt like it connected me to a tribe, and I would listen to a lot of classic rock, a lot of punk rock, heavy music, because that made me feel connected to what, you know, that's why a lot of people listen to music. I get the sense, though, you as a kid playing Beethoven or Bach, you were in it purely for the music, which I don't know if that's why I was in it at first. Were you with listening to Bach because you felt that connected you?
Yes.
To a tribe or to what?
No, it connected me. I just love the music.
That's what I'm saying. You just love the sound of it.
Yes. And it's funny. My younger brother, John, I have six siblings. My younger brother, John, has exactly the same taste. He knows everything. He knows all the same stuff about classical music and jazz and rock that I know.
Right.
Right. So it's strange that people don't know this.
That, yes, I understand. Right. Yeah. But I feel like I identify with my favorite musicians and that's why they're my favorite. Do you feel like you identify to any of the rockers or do you feel like that mentality or do you almost feel removed from the genre game and that's why you just love everything?
Yeah, I don't think about genres. I like music that I'm moved by, you know, yeah. And there can be so many. I have records that I love the sound of and I hate the music that I listen to. Because I'm like, God, that sounds amazing.
I almost want to ask for an example.
I don't want to give an example.
Okay, yeah.
But there are records that I have that I've listened to hundreds of times that I don't like, except for the sound is incredible.
Yes. When I interviewed Keith Williams from 5 Watt World for the podcast, he said that you are better at keeping in touch with people than anyone he's ever met. What's that about?
Never waste a friendship.
That's it. How do you do that? Or what does that mean?
You spend time. You know, you invest time in people that you are, you know, that are your friends. And I just never let that go. I'm still in touch with all my high school friends. I'm in touch with all my college friends. I'm, you know, I talk to them all the time.
Because you just text them all the time. You reach out to them all the time.
I call them. FaceTime them. Yeah.
Yeah. Who taught you that? Never waste a friendship. That's a beautiful phrase, right?
Nobody taught me that.
That's it.
My mom used to say, you got to write a letter to get a letter.
Yeah. That's it.
And that was important to me.
That's beautiful. Okay. You started your channel. You made a video every day because Casey Neistat made a video every day.
I tried to make a video every day. Yeah.
Was that the influence of Casey on you? Would you say he had any influence on the channel?
Absolutely.
What was the influence?
To me, it was amazing that a guy could make videos that looked as good as his did, and they had great stories, and he could do it every day. I just couldn't even fathom that. So I was like, maybe that's how you get good at this, by making videos every day. And you know what? It is how you get good at it. It's just like practicing.
That's it. So what are the tips for someone starting a YouTube channel? Maybe you don't want to share the secret sauce.
There is no secret.
There's no secret sauce. Okay. So first of all,
there's no secrets about anything related to music or anything like that.
Right. So first of all, we were talking about this earlier. In my world of music YouTubers in Nashville, we obsess a lot over the thumbnails and over the titles. Obviously, that's important. What is your take on that?
My take is, would I click on that?
Yeah. That's the metric that you use.
That's it. Yeah.
But there has to be something that's really it.
That's it.
It's just, would I click on this thumbnail?
Would I click on this thumbnail or title? Does this sound like something I would click on?
That's it.
That's it.
That's it. And then you'll watch the videos as they get posted and make edits in real time. Is that secret sauce or no?
What do you mean?
You will post a video
and
you will stare at the video for, I don't know, a couple of minutes or an hour, maybe not stare at it, but you will monitor it and then make edits or adjustments to the video in real time.
Well, I don't make adjustments to the video.
No, I'm sorry, not to the video, to the thumbnail or to the title.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If I feel like, I have a sense, I have an idea for how well most videos should do. And if they're not doing well, it's like, okay, then we've missed something, like the title or thumbnail might not be accurately representing it.
And that's what you think makes a difference. Then you see
Massive difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that I have an idea. So I have an idea for how every video should perform. And if it's not performing like I think it is, it's like, probably title or thumbnail. I usually try the title first and then the thumbnail. And sometimes it'll change it 5 times within the course of a couple hours.
I don't know if you want to get so technical, but I'm always curious about this because your videos always look great. Is there a camera that you think is best for YouTubers, or is there one that you really like to use or that you normally use?
I use Sony A7S4s.
Is that all the cameras that you, for?
No, the interviews that we do, we use FX9. Is that right, Tom?
We use A7S3s.
A7S3.
A7. So just A7.
A7. Then, these are all A7IVs, aren't they, Tom? Or one's an A7III?
One's an
A7S3. FX6, but Sony.
Yeah.
The color profiles, I like the way those look.
And your audio is always, I'm not gassing you up, your audio is always a touch above everyone else on YouTube. It really always is.
Well, you know.
How do you capture audio typically?
Neve Mike Priest.
Is that the secret though? Is that really what makes it work? So that's like, one, is that really it?
That's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And then what's your take? We were talking about
it. Like if you can't get a good,
yeah.
If you can't record a good vocal for an interview or something, but when I do my regular videos, I have a little Zoom mic that connects to the camera. And most of the time it's just that.
That's really? Because you're
like 4 or 5 feet away from me.
So do you connect when you're doing the interviews and people are wearing lavs? Does that go into the
Neves?
Yeah. That goes into the Neves.
Yeah.
And then when you do the videos over here, you're just using that stereo mic.
Yeah.
And it's a Zoom stereo mic?
Yeah.
And that's it?
Zoom H6, yeah. Plugged directly into the camera.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's the best.
Now, sometimes, occasionally, we'll use, I'll use a lav. Depends on what it is. Sometimes I'll use a lav and I'll put the battery pack that, you know, that'll record onto a recorder and put it in my pocket. And, you know, but there's a lot of, you know, some videos we'll have mic'd up. I had a pianist, Hiromi, that was in here, great jazz pianist. And she, you know, we had the three Shep's mics on the piano and then we had overhead Sennheiser shotgun mics and we had lavs on, right? So, cause you never know what direction you're facing. And sometimes you want to go where you want to use the close mics in the piano. Oh, and we had Cole's 4038 room mics also. And so it was kind of a blend of those things. And then you're cutting back and forth between the lavs and then you got to mute the lavs when she's playing, but sometimes she's talking and playing. It gets really tricky. So sometimes you use AI and you'll isolate the vocal from the...
What AI tool do you use for that?
Lalal.ai. Many times we'll use that.
Yeah.
Or you can use the Logic Pro stem splitter do it.
And how do you think about lighting for the space? Because the room always looks perfectly lit in all your videos.
We light differently for different videos. We're using a lot of... you know, we have hair lights that are up here that are aiming down towards us. And we each have our own soft box here that are illuminating us. And then the natural light, we're using white lights out here, but we're using ambient 3000 Kelvin, or is it 3200, Tom? 3200 Kelvin lights in the background, which are whiter. And, if you use regular incandescent that are 2700, they look green, at least because of the Sony cameras. And so you have to kind of, this actually helps. I think we set the cameras at normally when I'm set back there at 4700, the camera is the front lights at 5500 and the back lights are 3200. Is that right, Tom?
Yep.
And you edit everything in Final Cut Pro.
Yeah.
And how important, you've talked about at one point early in your channel, you may have switched to 4K and that really made a difference in the performance of your videos, or who knows?
Well, my first video that I did in 4K is my biggest video.
The acoustic guitar one? Yeah.
It's also one of the worst looking videos. It's 4K, but it's so dark. My God. I forgot to turn the lights on the back.
Yeah. Any other secret sauce? This is the other thing people say behind your back, Rick, is how good your videos look. Any other secret sauce to achieve that?
You know, a lot of the stuff is the lighting. That's the cameras are so good now that if you get the stuff in focus, and things like when you're playing a guitar, don't have guitars behind you that are creating a cross. Right.
You what make do you sure mean, that across?
Like if I'm playing guitar here, right,
yeah,
and you have guitars behind me and you're filming me this way, I don't want to see a bunch of straight lines going up like that and then have the guitar here. I'd rather see something that has a depth of field that doesn't have anything that's interrupting the that's crossing the neckline.
Right.
Right. Just like having things that are coming out of your head that are behind you. So you have to.
What comes out of your head?
A beam or something behind you, that's sticking up or anything like that. Or a light that's really bright right behind your head or something like that's obscuring. Just things that are obvious, but I am super obsessive. So is Tom about these things looking like that. And I just naturally notice them.
Yeah. How early in a YouTuber's career do you think they can start a course?
It's hard to say because I had my book that I wrote back in the 80s, my Beato book. So I started it 30 years before the internet was invented or something, or no, like 6 years before the internet was invented. So I think it's probably different for everyone.
How early, because you spend so much time on your courses, because people, there's a great interest in the courses from you, right?
Yeah.
But is like, if you're starting out, what, is there anything on tap to make a course on at this point?
I think it's just a matter of everyone has their own style of the things that they teach. So I think it's more personal. People want to learn just like the channels that you decide to watch. You like someone's vibe and you develop a relationship with kind of the type of content that they present, no matter what it is. I don't watch a lot of music channels. I watch my friends' channels.
Yeah. What do you watch on YouTube though?
Depends. And I'll go through periods where I'll watch different things. That outdoors guy that goes and camps up in Alaska and stuff.
That guy's unbelievable, right?
Outdoors guy.
Why does that guy do that? It seems so miserable. What's his name? The Outdoor Boys, right? Yeah, he stopped doing it though, didn't he?
Yeah, but
you love exit YouTube videos, right?
That's what my favorite genre is, YouTube quitting videos.
Did he make a YouTube quitting video?
He kind of did, but it wasn't really. It wasn't a proper YouTube quitting video. He didn't say, oh, I appreciate the audience and everything, and I appreciate this and I appreciate that, and I'm not complaining, and because I always wait for all the things that everybody says because they all sound exactly.
Why do you love this so much?
Because I think every YouTuber can relate to it.
You in this video though about YouTube quitting videos, you said something like you said a couple things that I actually thought were pretty profound, which was, first of all, you don't release videos on any kind of schedule.
No.
Which I think actually probably helps you not to burn out, right?
I release a video when it's done.
Like, yeah.
Literally as soon as it's done, it's out in 5 minutes.
But what is your obsession with the YouTube quitting videos? Because somehow you haven't quit and I don't think you're going to quit anytime soon, right?
I love to listen to them because to see what people say.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And I can relate to the things that they say about how difficult the schedule is, for example, like Andrew Wong, who's a music YouTuber. So he made this one quitting video years ago. He doesn't quit, of course. No, because nobody makes YouTube quitting videos. Very few YouTubers actually quit. And he talked about what his average day is like and stuff. And that he's at his computer all day. His wife comes home and everything. He's still working. He's working here. He's working on the weekends. He's working this. He's always at it. And it's like, yeah, I can relate to all that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Wow. That's amazing. And I just, you can relate to it so much, but I watched them to see what, some that like Tom Scott did a YouTube quitting video that was really well done. And he got lifted by a helicopter off this runway after he did this incredibly long monologue. And he stayed off YouTube, I think. I don't think Tom back on now? I don't think so.
Wouldn't it be great if you did one that was just epic? and then came back next week or whatever, just to do it, to do it?
No, I said when I'm doing my YouTube quitting video is going to be just all of a sudden there's just no more videos.
That's what I think too. Why would you ever make some grand announcement? Like, you think anyone's looking at you that closely? Like, why would you make a grand announcement? Just stop making videos and then come back if you want to.
I tell people that, you know, my friends, I'm like, yeah, if I quit, people will forget I was ever on the internet within about 3 months, maybe. Maybe that long. Maybe not even that long.
No, we love you, Rick. We'll keep going back to your content.
I don't believe it.
You did a hearing, a Senate hearing, where you talked about fair use. You frequently say that you don't really prepare for your interviews. Did you prepare for that hearing?
Well, you had to prepare because you had to bring a written statement that I turned in. And... you know, I thought about what I was going to say when they asked me questions. And one of the things that you know, a lot of the I mean, they'd never do anything about any of this stuff. So it doesn't, you know, I did the hearing, but with the knowledge that the chances of anything coming out of this and making any type of laws related to this, the last laws were from 1998 or so, just like any regulation of AI ain't going to happen. It's not going to happen.
But you said yes, just for the, do you value the experience of it? Or like,
the experience and, you know, if I got asked to do it, so I did it. I felt like it was you can ask by Congress, you know, some congressional hearing, a Senate hearing. I've done two different ones. I did one on fair use. I did one on AI. And I felt it was my, you know, I was asked, I'm an American. I'm going to go and testify and give my opinion.
Don't you think it's a bummer that they don't film those things? Like, would that be a great YouTube video to watch you testifying in that room?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. The one I did, the AI one, I was one of 19 people.
Yeah.
So.
Why do you say you're not sure? Because you think it might be a little dry, all the footage? Or what happens in that room?
Well, the room, the AI one, was closed door hearing. Mine was a seventh of nine. And the first batch of people was, you know, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, all the head people of all these massive companies were asked about this. And then in the one I was in, and when I say it's closed door, there was nobody from the public. There were other senators that came in and sat in, and people from the media would come in and sit in, but there was no live feed or anything like that. And there were people from the Motion Picture Association. There were people from Spotify. There's people from universities. They had professors and that were these AI experts that were part of the panel too, giving their, they had people from all different, but a lot of lobbyists and things like that. And me.
You have to feel though, you have to know that you're going to sit in this panel and you're going to be very engaging because you've spent so much time engaging people on YouTube. You must have this feeling that you're more engaging than everyone else who's speaking on the panel, I would imagine.
I don't think about that.
Really? That's all I would think about if I was Rick Beato. I'd say, no. God, I'm so great at this. I'm so engaging.
No, I don't think about that. I don't care about that.
But what did you think was your goal to try to get your fair use thoughts across and let them hear anything or whatever?
I just answered the questions and gave them my opinion. I had no goals and I wasn't under any, I didn't have, I thought the chances of them doing anything was so small that, you know, I was like, yes, I'll go testify, but I know nothing's going to come of this. That was kind of my attitude.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So, and that's pretty much what happened.
But you wore great shoes. Wore the Converse with the suit.
Well, you know.
Okay. You always do the Spotify top 50 or top 10 viral songs. Your frustration frequently aligns with the lack of harmony, variation, or whatever. Can you just give a couple, even if it's very, very simple, couple little music theory things that if a songwriter is in a room writing a 1-4-5 or a 6 minor or whatever, just something they can throw in to just make their song a little bit more interesting?
I don't know, a three major chord or something. Or
a three major chord.
Yeah. It depends. I mean, you can't, I can't generalize about a song. Nowadays songs are so simplistic that, although a lot of the AI songs that I've heard actually have much more interesting, chord progressions and stuff, probably because they're trained on older songs.
That's the, isn't that, what do you equate that to though?
I don't know. Probably to that.
But to the simplicity of.
Now there is no radio that people really listen to per se. So it's when, you know, 10 years ago when people listened to the radio, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, every song was 1, 4, 5, and 6. Every song on country radio, every song on pop radio was those four chords. And then because to the A&R people at the time, that when they used to be A&R people, nothing sounded like a hit unless it was that chord progression. So everyone wrote songs like that because they knew that there was no chance of getting a single if you were a songwriter unless you had a track record like Max Martin, because Max Martin did not write a lot of songs like that. But he was Max Martin. He had hits and he didn't have to resort to that. But most people that were writing songs would write those songs because A&R people thought they sounded like hits. It's kind of a strange.
That was it.
Strange thing. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite kind of hidden part or sound that you've discovered from your What Makes the Song Great videos?
I like the keyboard part in the chorus of All the Small Things by Blink-182.
Your first video, that's what inspired you to make the video, right? Was that little dissonant part, right?
Yeah.
It's an octave, right?
It's a C octave, and then the goes down, there's a harmony part that goes down to B in there on the G chord,
yeah,
and stuff, but it's playing that sus4 up there and it sounds amazing.
You know what you point out that you can't listen to or I can't ignore ever again is the bass line in More Than a Feeling from Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Never noticed that bass line.
It's all over the place.
Until I watched your video on it.
Yeah, it's like a Motown bass line.
Isn't it incredible?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Rick Beato, this is unbelievable. Thanks for letting us in. What's been unsaid? What have we left out?
I don't know.
The Scale Matrix course is out now.
Yeah.
It's out now. It's for pre-order, right?
No, It's
been released. You did a video on it yesterday. You felt this needed to be out there. You felt people needed to understand scales.
I wanted to have a dedicated scale course to go. I had an arpeggio course first. Kind of seemed backwards. You should really do the scale course first, then the arpeggios, because there's less notes.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think that every artist should be spending more time on YouTube to connect with their fans and discover? It feels like a lot of them really don't.
YouTube, it's hard to connect with fans on YouTube unless you're doing live streams. And if you have a big channel, then the live streams, that stuff flies by so fast that you can't even, it's hard to read unless people do a super chat or whatever. I don't like when people do super chats, even though it's nice that people, donate money for you because ultimately, a portion of the super chats go to YouTube. I think people don't realize that. And also people can monopolize the questions because they can afford to pay money to put their question in front of you. So sometimes I'll get on videos and say, please no super chats, because I want to just read the questions and just pick them out. And I don't want to feel like I have to do it because somebody paid the money to do it, you know? So I'd rather just not get any super chats and answer things that I think more people will be interested in.
That makes sense. What are the advantages to living in Atlanta to do this? I guess you could do it from anywhere, but wouldn't it be easier to live in New York or LA or Nashville?
No, it's far easier to live in Atlanta because you can fly anywhere from here.
Yeah.
People can fly in. Everything's direct because of Delta.
So when people fly in, they just stay. When you have the most legendary guests who come to the studio, maybe they're playing locally in town, but I'm sure a lot of them fly in. And then do you pick them up or how did they get here?
They get driven here.
They get driven here.
Yeah.
they come in, and that's like, isn't it crazy how many legendary people you've brought to your home in Atlanta?
I don't think about it. It just, I guess I'm used to it.
Yeah. Do you feel like you strike me as someone who is so just forward thinking, not very sentimental? One thing I'll reference is the bass, your uncle's bass.
Yeah.
It cracked me up when Joe said at first, he was like, do you want to buy the bass back? And you said, no. Right. And I go, of course you should buy the bass back, Rick.
That's what my brother said.
That's what your brother said. What? Why did you think you shouldn't have bought the bass back?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why I said that. I just was not. I don't have a connection with instruments that people have. To me, they're just things to, you know, tools to use. So the, that's why I don't have I don't really have vintage guitars or anything like that. I like things that play really well and that sound good. And I don't care what it is. And there's other things that sound good too. So, I don't get attached to instruments.
Where's that bass? Have you used that bass on anything?
No.
It just hangs out.
I just used it for that one video.
And then, but you still have it, right?
I do,
Yeah.
Yeah. It's around here somewhere.
It's an incredible story, right? Isn't it cool to hold on to those things though? Or what?
Great to hold on to them.
Yeah.
But you know, ultimately if I could sell every guitar in here and I could sell every piece of gear in here and never think about it again.
That's it. Yeah.
I don't know what that says, but
yeah,
I just don't get attached to things like that. I value friendships over everything else. Everything else is like, you know.
I feel like that honestly, though, says how you're able to have so much knowledge of everything, because I feel like I become connected to things that you identify with and almost become sentimental about my favorite bands. My favorite bands in high school are still my favorite bands. But I feel like you have this different connection to music that allows you to be so broad and appreciate so much, where I feel like I would love this knowledge, but a lot of this music I don't relate to or connect to.
Well, you have to give it a chance.
You have to give it a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you close yourself off, I mean, right there, the way that you're describing it.
Yeah. Well, I think I've given it, maybe I should give it more of a chance, but I've spent a lot of time listening to a lot of these records and jazz albums and everything, and I never find myself loving the music or just totally engaging with them. And I want to engage with them. Like, I want to be open-minded, but I struggle with Kind of Blue or, you know, Bitches Brew or whatever. I'm naming Miles Davis, but I struggle with a lot of jazz records that are classics that I want to love because I know people like you have such a deep appreciation for them. So I'll sit there and I'll listen. I'll really try to get into them, and I struggle with them.
Well, maybe that jazz doesn't connect with you. Maybe there's other jazz that does connect with you.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not Miles Davis. Maybe it's not hard bop of the 1950s or the 1960s. Maybe it's Keith Jarrett and it's records of, you know, like Belonging from 1974 with a Scandinavian or European quartet. Maybe that record would connect with you, whereas, because it's very different kind of music. It's improvisational based music, but the melodies are very different and they're not based on bebop. So maybe you're just not listening to the right things.
I need to listen to the right things to get into them.
There you go.
But I feel like your identity is so tied to the music you listen to that's sort of, I think, where sometimes people get held up with it.
That's very interesting. Yeah, so I think when people think about me, they don't necessarily think about any style of music.
That's exactly my point. Yes. Yeah.
I always say that, I'm not a guitarist. That, you know, I said that, and somebody was asked me, you know, so many people asked me to play, oh, will you play on this video and everything? I'm like, no, not really a guitar player. And what? And I think of myself as a musician. I play guitar, I play bass, I play a bunch of instruments, but I don't think people necessarily think of me strictly as a guitarist, or they don't associate me with any particular genre of music.
That's what I think is interesting. Yeah. Cause you just love it all. That's
yeah.
Yeah.
I love good music. I love all good music.
That's it. Rick Beato, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to do this.
Very welcome.
This was so fun. And I've been watching your videos now probably for at least 6 or 7 years for sure. Pre-pandemic. And you're the best.
I appreciate it. Happy to do it.
You have such a noble cause, right? Think about how many people you've taught music to and expanded their minds and their knowledge. I still go back. I watched your video on compression, why I need to learn about compression.
Nice. In
the studio. Your EQ video on the whiteboard, you were whiteboarding all this stuff. And it's unbelievable, right?
Well, I was like, you know, you want to convey information, just do it like a lecture.
Is your son going to become a great musician? I know he's started playing guitar. You talk about a little bit, right?
He's not. I have no idea what he's going to do. Like when I was 18, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Actually, that's not true. I wanted to be a musician.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know what he wants to do.
What did you think that meant when you were 18? You thought you were going to become did you think you were going to be in a rock band, or did you think you were going to be a session musician, or?
No, I wanted to go to school for music because I wanted to learn more about music.
Yeah.
That's it.
That was it.
I just want to learn more about music. Yeah.
Did you feel like until your YouTube channel, did you feel like you had made it with your producing, or did you feel like you made it when you had a number one song with Parmalee, or did you feel like you were searching for something higher, or none of that?
None of that.
None of that.
No.
You were very content, and then the YouTube channel just was its own thing.
Well, you know, I acquired all these skills throughout my lifetime. And the YouTube channel was a perfect place to
display them.
Yes.
Or share them.
I guess. Yeah. Share them.
Share them. Yeah.
And honestly, most of the people that I knew that have been friends of mine for years knew nothing about my background, about all the different types of music that I know about. So, and a lot of my friends that are pro players and everything, they can't relate to jazz. They don't relate to classical music.
Right. That's my problem. I have a hard time relating to these genres, but I want to, Rick.
And I can't relate to the fact that they can't relate to it.
Yeah. I understand that. I get that. Yeah. So how do we open our minds? You gave a little bit of an example of keep searching and to be open-minded and to just start listening. That's an obvious example, but I think sometimes I think this comes so easily to you, and I think people struggle with it, trying to open their minds to other genres of music.
Well, I think when I was growing up, music was, there was less music out there, right? Hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah.
A lot of it back in the 60s and 70s. And life was a lot simpler. Didn't have any distractions. You could just sit there and listen to a record and do nothing. Just stare at the wall. And I did a lot of that. And so, plus playing in ensembles. I played in ensembles where I read music and played with big ensembles. You know, I played with not only in orchestras, but wind ensembles, where I was the only bass player. They have one bass in every concert band or wind ensemble, one acoustic bass player. It's the only string instrument they have. And I would always play in that. So I was constantly in these environments where I was playing with massive groups of people playing orchestral music. And when you play in ensembles or in small ensembles as well, chamber orchestras, it's such a different thing. You're reading, you're playing a non-fretted instrument. You got to play in tune. There's just so many, just that alone, reading music, you know, I'm reading and playing.
Yeah.
And you're playing with ensemble. You have a conductor. You're watching the conductor. You're looking over your stand. You're playing. You're watching the conductor. And every bowing has to be right. Everybody's bow needs to be going the same direction and everything. So these are things that, you know, when you're playing on a blues gig, you're not thinking about that stuff. You're just playing over the tune and everything. And it's a completely different kind of thing. So maybe it's... that because I had that experience, and that's part of my kind of the core part of my experience as a musician is playing in ensembles as a, from being a kid. That's a kind of a different thing. It's not like people that grew up playing in rock bands. Then I played in rock bands after that. So
do you relate to that study, or people always say that your favorite music, you basically stop discovering your favorite music past whatever the age is, 25, I think, or something like that. Is there music you discovered later in life that you would categorize as your favorite music, or is your favorite music still what you were listening to in high school and college?
No, I am discovering new music all the time that I love listening to. So I can never say what my favorite music is.
Yeah.
Favorite music is whatever I'm interested in listening to today.
How do you listen to music on AirPods? Just walking, wandering around?
In the car?
Yeah.
Or through the monitor speakers here?
Do you trick out a stereo in your car, or it's just the stock stereo?
Stock stereo.
Stock stereo. Rick Beato, you're the best. You're a legend.
Thanks, Zach. Appreciate it.
You're incredible. Thanks for taking the time.
You're very welcome.